Colonel J.P. Beer, surname spelled B-E-E-R, at his home, 3481 Cardiff Place. Colonel Beer, M-B-E-C-D, served with artillery battery overseas during the war. What we'll be talking about today. My name is David Ganser, G-A-N-T-Z-E-R. Colonel, perhaps you could tell us something about your early background and how you decided to get into the forces.
Yeah. I was born in February 1920 in Charlottetown, Prince Edward Island, and I attended public school, of course. And in those days, when you attended public school, you were invited to join a cadet corps if you felt so inclined. In those days, the cadet corps, Army cadet corps, were sponsored by public schools. And most of us thought we'd join. We learned such things as semaphore, first aid, basic things like that, which was good fun, and we all seemed to enjoy it. So much so that when we were too old to be cadets, most of us joined a militia unit. And in those days, the two militia units in Charlottetown were both artillery, the 2nd Medium Battery and the 8th Medium Battery, two independent batteries. And some of us joined the 2nd Battery and others joined the 8th. I happened to join the 8th, that doesn't really matter. But I guess it was 36 that I joined the, no, 37 it would be, that I joined the 8th Medium Battery as a gunner, and served with that battery pre-war. And in September of 39, when Canada went to war, my battery, 8th Battery, was mobilized on the 2nd of September. And I, like everybody else, joined up automatically. You didn't even question it, I can remember. I went down on the Saturday morning and I signed up and went home and told my mother, and she just broke into tears. My father came home and he was pleased as punch, so you couldn't please everybody.
Did your father have a military background?
None whatsoever. He had never served. He suffered from ulcers all his life, but he had never served in the military in any way, shape, or form. I had two uncles who served in World War I. They both happened to be artillery, but that had no connection with the reason why I joined the militia, none whatsoever. I just enjoyed cadets, so I thought I'd like to try militia, and I enjoyed the militia.
This was in Charlottetown?
This was in Charlottetown, right. So when war broke out, I was a gunner, a rank of gunner. And in February, we were stationed in Charlottetown at that time, and it was an odd situation. It's hard for a person to visualize, a person who didn't go through it. I can remember that there were no uniforms to be issued. We had the old World War I type uniform with putties and bandoliers and this sort of thing. We had no paymaster, and one of the officers in the battery was detailed to be the paymaster, just like that. And because, I don't know why, at one stage, in those early days, I was detailed to be pay sergeant. I didn't know much about paying or accounting, but I was detailed to be the pay sergeant anyway. And at another stage, I was detailed to be the battery quartermaster sergeant, another thing I knew very little about. However, in those days, it was tough because there was very little equipment to train with. There were no training areas in Charlottetown. I can remember the first place we moved into was the exhibition grounds, and they weren't heated. There were no beds or bunks, and you had to go home in the evenings to sleep. And initially, there were no rations provided, and you had to go home for your meals. Eventually, that was sorted out. And a little later on in 39, we were moved out to a big luxury hotel called Beech Grove Inn, which was heated and had kitchens, and this is where we then lived and were fed. But in those days, it was pretty rough and hard to visualize.
What sort of training were they giving you at this time? What were they teaching you?
Very, very little. How to handle a rifle, I guess, and we did have a couple of guns, 18-pounders, and we did do some gun drill. We did some semaphore and Morse, that's true. Heliograph, which was another instrument used for signaling. It was terribly, terribly basic, and a lot of the time was spent in drawing kit and cleaning up the buildings, the quarters, the barracks, and so on. As a pay sergeant, I was stuck in an office all the time. As a battery quartermaster sergeant, I was pretty well desk-bound, too. And the reason I was made a quartermaster sergeant is amusing, I think. The battery quartermaster sergeant got drunk one night and got into trouble, and the battery commander reduced him in rank to a bombardier. And his appointment of battery quartermaster sergeant was taken away from him, and I was told, you're going to act as battery quartermaster sergeant. In those days, it was fantastic. There was no issue of rations. I can remember you'd phone your favorite grocer and give him an idea of what you wanted ordered, and they would deliver it. The grocery store would deliver the rations to the building wherever you were, and the cooks would take the rations over and prepare the meals from there. It was a crazy mixed up business, I must say. Anyway, we've survived, but in February of 1940, I, with I think it was four other people in the battery, were all commissioned. And this gives you an idea of how short of officers the Canadian artillery was. We were all called in and told to take the afternoon off and be at the railway station the next morning wearing one pip on our shoulder to take the train to Kingston, the artillery officer training center, Fort Frontenac, where we underwent our officer training.
And this was, what, you just turned 20?
Yes, I just turned 20, that's correct, 20 years of age. And we arrived in Kingston in February 1940, and we trained there, winter training, classroom stuff, until May, when the training was moved up to Petawawa, and then we went and got out in the field and did the field training side of it.
What was a typical day in the officer training?
It's awfully hard for me to remember, quite frankly. We spent a lot of time on artillery tactics, deployment of guns. I can remember we took motorcycle training as well. We had instruction on army trucks, which in those days were Leylands. We even got some instruction on motor mechanics, you know, the engine of a vehicle and how to maintain it and so on. We had a lot of deployments in the field with guns. Not that we had that many guns, but we had enough to get by, I think, for training purposes. And, of course, you always had PT in the morning and drill on the square and lectures at night, and time was not wasted. So we graduated, I think it was, in late June or early July of 1940. And then the whole course was sent overseas in early August as reinforcement officers. And we arrived in Greenock, I guess it was, in early August. And we're sent down to Borden Hants, which in those days was a Canadian reinforcement or holding unit, where reinforcement officers and personnel, not just officers, all ranks, were held and did more training until they were required in various units. So we arrived there in August, and I only spent 4 weeks there. We were all lieutenants by then. You know, once you passed your course, you became a lieutenant. And 4 weeks after we arrived in Borden, seven of us were sent out to 1RCHA, that is the 1st Regiment Royal Canadian Horse Artillery, as reinforcement officers, because the Canadian artillery was reorganizing in those days onto three battery bases, two troops per battery, and this required a lot of additional officers. So seven of us went out there, and Guy Granville Simmons was the commanding officer at that time.
And this was what, Bromley?
This
Bromley
was
Kent.
In Bromley Kent, I believe it was, yeah, Bromley Kent, that's right. And we arrived and were introduced to Colonel Simmons, who said, well, I don't know how much you know about artillery, but I've got to find out, so you'll all write an examination. Which we did. Six of us failed. One person passed. The fellow who passed stayed on in 1RCHA. The rest of us were posted out to other units because we weren't good enough to stay in the first rate.
Was this more a product of Guy Simmons' high ideals or a lack of training on your part?
No, I would say it was a lack of training on our part. Although we underwent training in Kingston and Petawawa, Looking back on it now, I can honestly say that the training was not not very good. The standard was not high. And really, when we got on the ship to go overseas, oh yes, I knew something about artillery, but so little, so very, very little, compared to officers who had already been overseas and were part of the battery. So, no, I would not blame Guy Granville Simmons for that. To write an exam was, I think, quite right, and that was the only way he could find out quickly how much we knew about artillery, but I would criticize him for not training us himself. Instead of training us himself, he sent us out, posted us out to other units, and sloughed the responsibility off onto other commanding officers. However,
can you say something about the state of England at the time, the apprehended threat of invasion? What measures
yes,
you were given to repel?
Yes, I can. If we could go back a bit to when the 4 weeks we were in Borden, it was during that time that the real scare came, that everyone was convinced that the Germans were in fact going to invade the UK. And whether you listened to the radio or what you did, that was the talk. You could go into a pub and that was the talk, invasion. And everyone was certain that the invasion was going to take place. And at one stage, when we were still in Borden, it reached the climax, and there was a real scare, and we were all called in and issued with weapons and ammunition. And being an officer, being officers, we all expected to be issued with pistols and ammunition, but there was such a shortage of weapons in the UK at that time that there were no pistols, not for us anyway. And we were issued, as officers, were issued with 303 rifles and 50 rounds of ammunition, and that's all we had. Given certain area of responsibility for which we had to look after.
A certain geographical area?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. But that was it. There we were with a rifle and 50 rounds of ammunition. So it was a pretty scary time because we were all new to the country. Most of us had never been to Europe before. Certainly didn't know England. And the air raids were going on pretty healthy. So this trip to London, the weekend was pretty scary, and it was an eye-opener to me because there were fires. You could see fires going. You could hear the air raid sirens and the searchlights and the fighters overhead, bombers overhead. And that really opened my eyes to what was going on in the UK at that time. And it's a typical example of why everyone was keyed up, prepared for this proposed invasion, which of course didn't happen. So, to get back to Bromley, where I was with the 1st Regiment, having failed the exam, another officer and myself were cross-posted to the 11th Army Field Regiment, which was in just outside Guildford in Surrey. And there the commanding officer was a Lieutenant Colonel Crowe, Doug Crowe, whose two sons, John and Denny, both served under me much later on in peacetime in Germany, as a matter of fact. Colonel Crowe had the same problem. He was reorganizing. He also said, you must write an exam. We wrote the exam. To this day, I've never been told whether we passed or failed, but I can assume we failed because we were both sent out on British courses. And this, I thought, was a hell of a good solution to the problem. And this is when I first started to learn something about artillery. So Colonel Crowe, instead of farming us out to some other unit, took it upon himself to get us trained. And I stayed with that unit from December 40 until June 1942. And there's not much to be said what happened then. It was training all day, every day. We spent many, many long hours in training. I was sent away in various courses. I started off in my battery, which was the 40th Battery from Hamilton, Ontario. I started off in the junior position of troop leader, eventually worked up to the next position as a lieutenant assistant command post officer, and then gun position officer and command post officer, all lieutenant's appointments, until 1942, when I was away on a battle drill school, which was most exciting, to come back to the factory to be told that I'd been promoted and posted. So I left 11th Army Field Regiment in June of 1940 and was posted as a captain, troop commander, to the 12th Field Regiment, which was in somewhere in Hants, and I can't remember the exact name of the town, but the 12th Field Regiment was part of the 3rd Division, which was eventually the Assault Division, Canadian Assault Division on D-Day.
Okay, if we can go back when you were the 11th Army Field Regiment, this is where you got your primary training for what happened.
That is quite correct. Yep, this is where I started to learn something about artillery and where I got my primary training and was sent away on, I must have had four or five different courses during that period of time I was with the 11th Army Field Regiment. And between taking courses and getting out in the field and doing the various appointments of lieutenant, this is how you learn, or where you learn how to be an artillery officer.
You were with primarily other Canadian officers, or
yes.
Commonwealth officers, or what?
All Canadian officers in the unit, but the courses we took were invariably British courses, and the instructors, of course, were British. The British courses used to allocate so many vacancies to Canadians. This is how we got on the British courses.
Socially, how did you get on with the rest of the people in England? There was many different types of troops and civilians.
Yeah, in fact, in those days, unless you went out to a pub in the evenings, and to be perfectly honest, I was a teetotaler in those days, so I didn't go out to pub, you didn't mix that much with the civilian population. The regiment would have its own officer's mess, its own sergeant's mess, and in off-duty hours, you'd find the officers in their mess and the sergeants in their mess. During the day, most of the week, you were training all the time, so you didn't mix with the civilian population that much. I got involved because another officer and myself were detailed to attend a nurse's dance at a British hospital in Guildford on Boxing Night of 1940. And we went to this dance and enjoyed ourselves and had quite a good time, and got to know some of the younger girls who were nurses at that function. And in fact, as an aside, that's where I met my wife that night, and we were married in 1943. But other than that, you didn't have much to do with the civilians, in fact.
You were training all the time, and kept fairly busy.
Yeah, I would say 6 days a week, right. And sometimes in the evenings, too.
Can you recall, sir, what you were drawing in the way of pay?
No, I can't. I'm sorry. I really can't tell you. It was so long ago, I just can't remember. It was very little, but, you know, in those days, you thought it was a tremendous amount.
And provided for your needs?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so you're detailed from the 12th Field Regiment, or rather to the 12th Field Regiment, 3rd Canadian Division.
Right.
I see. And you were a troop commander?
Troop commander, yes, which meant that there were two troops in the battery. The battery is commanded by a major, and the troops commanded by a captain. Now, the way the Canadian and British artillery, Commonwealth artillery, work, the senior officers go forward with the infantry when you're in battle. And the more experienced senior people are up forward with the infantry as the advisors, artillery advisors, to the infantry commanders. For example, the troop commander artillery, captain, is the artillery advisor in the front line to the company commander, infantry. And the next level up, the battery commander of an artillery battery is the advisor to the battalion commander, the infantry battalion commander, and so on right up the line. This is the way the Canadian and Commonwealth Army artilleries work. The American artillery does not. They do it in a reverse manner. They have their senior officers back at the gun positions commanding the guns, and their junior officers, the second lieutenants and lieutenants, are forward as forward observers and provide the artillery support. The major difference, in my opinion, is that the junior American officers are not allowed to order fire. They may only request it, and some senior officer back at the gun position decides whether or not they will provide the fire. Whereas in the British Commonwealth system, the person forward, troop commander, batch commander, commanding officer, and so on, have the authority to order fire. They don't request it, they order it, and it is provided automatically. And that, in my opinion, is the major difference between the two systems. So as a troop commander in the 12th Field, I was commanding, I think it's about 60-some-odd people, three officers, including myself, four guns, four 25-pounders, and the two troops together in the battery formed an 8-gun battery. So as a troop commander, I was responsible for all aspects of the troop, but in battle, I would be deployed forward, supporting a company of infantry.
These were 25-pound guns?
25-pounders, yep. Very, very fine weapon, first-class weapon. Really proved themselves, first of all, in the Sahara Desert under Montgomery and those battles against Rommel. That's where the 25-pounder first proved itself. And it was just a tremendous gun all the way through the war and for many, many years after the war, too. It was a very versatile weapon and a very accurate, consistent weapon. Excellent. So, what else can I tell you about the 12th Field? Well, as I said, it was part of the 3rd Division, 3rd Canadian Infantry Division, which was the assault division on D-Day, so the 12th Field Regiment was part of that assault on D-Day. Now, by the time we came to that, June 44, we had had 4 years of training, so we should have been in pretty good shape. When the invasion took place, I was no longer commanding a troop. I had been elevated to the appointment of 2IC, second in command of the battery, which meant I was still captain, but second in command to the major commanding the battery. And as second in command of the battery, I was responsible for basically the administration and supply and this sort of thing. I really was not part of the providing the fire support in effect. So on D-Day, I went in as battery captain and went in on the second wave of troops, not the assault wave, the second wave, bringing in the echelon. That is the ammunition supply, the rations, the petrol, and this sort of thing, the battery office and so on. And whereas the battery proper, the fighting element of the battery, landed early in the morning on D-Day, the echelon did not get in until sometime in the evening. I can't remember what time it was. In the evening of D-Day.
Okay, sir. If I could just take you back.
Yeah.
The prelude to D-Day. There was a lot of secrecy. When did you find out something was happening and the lead up to it? Secrecy?
Well, if you go back a bit during our training days, I think everybody realized that someday we were going to have to land in Europe, in Normandy, in continental Europe. Who was going to land and where they were going to land and when they were going to land were unknowns, of course. And when we were training, we had no idea that the 3rd Division would be the Canadian Division, would be part of the assaulting troops. So we just carried on with our training, and of course, eventually we were involved in amphibious exercises, training in England and Scotland. And then, the light started to come on, and we'd say, well, why are we involved in assault exercises? Does this mean we're going to be part of the D-Day landing? So eventually, as your training went on, it would sink in, and soon we realized that, we were likely going to be part of the assault division, assault troops. And then, of course, they took away our towed 25-pounders. This came later, I beg your pardon. They had us firing from landing craft, the four guns of a troop deployed on the craft itself, firing on the assault going in, firing from the craft, and the rounds landing on the enemy, presumably, on the ground. And this indicated that, sure, we've got to be part of it. And eventually, closer to D-Day, we were all put in concentration camps. That's a terrible term, but that's in fact what they were called. And they were enclosed by barbed wire, and they were in the south part of England. And this is where you were put, and you were not allowed out because of the secrecy security aspect. And I'm not sure how long. I think we spent a week or 10 days in those concentration camps in the South Coast. Ours was near Southampton. And there we stayed, and until one day they said they loaded us on the ships, and we thought, well, this is it. But then the weather was bad, and it was so bad that there was no way we could land on the 5th of June. And this is when Eisenhower had to make his decision and postpone it until the 6th of June. And on the 6th of June, the weather was better, but not that much better. But Eisenhower decided to go anyway. And this is when we got our briefings on board the craft and told where we were going, what we were doing, issued with maps, and issued with money, and etc. And it wasn't until we got on those ships
that you were actually told.
That we actually told where we were going.
Did that surprise you? Did you?
No.
You,
where we were going.
Where were we going? Normandy, as opposed to the Pas de Calais.
No, I don't think we really had any clue as to whether it'd be one or the other. I don't think we really cared that much. All we knew was, the important thing was that we were going in. This was the big day, D-Day as it was eventually called, and we were going to land in occupied territory. And the important thing was to land and get inland and get established and carry on the war from there. Whether it was in the Pas de Calais or the Normandy, I don't think we were terribly concerned about that.
Can you recall the briefing, what amount of information they told you specifically?
Yeah, they gathered us around on the ship, and they told us that this D-Day was going to be next day, 6th of June, H-hour was such and such a time, and here was the plan. 3rd British Division was going in here, 3rd Canadian Division in here, follow-up troops coming in here, Americans over here, British paratroopers here, and here are the names of the various beaches, here are your objectives. What else?
Your objective was to be what? We have a map here.
Yeah. Well, the Canadian Division objective was this road running between Caen and Bayeux, which is just off the map here. But as far as our sector was concerned, it was this road running west from Caen through Bretteville-L'Orgueilleuse and eventually on to Bayeux. That was our objective. And in fact, the Canadians did reach that objective. And the Canadians were one of the few to reach their objectives on D-Day. But after that, it was one terrible battle, and we had to fight for every inch of land.
I see. You landed towards the evening of the 6th.
Towards the evening, yeah.
And were detailed to lead your column?
Yeah. Yeah.
Towards that position?
Yeah, I was detailed to take my column from the beaches through the minefields onto the road and up to the battery position, which was just north of Caron. Somehow, being green, inexperienced, and not very clever, I guess, I overshot the turn and ended up in the FDLs on the actual road running west out of Caen, where I was stopped by an irate Armored Corps officer who said, "What in hell are you doing here?" And I tried to tell him, and he said, "Get the hell out of here, you're in the front lines." So I did, but we did draw shell fire from the Germans, I'm afraid, but we had no casualties, and we got out and went back down the road, and then I found the turn into the battery position.
Okay. Your batteries were supporting elements of the 3rd Canadian Division
yes.
along the road, which was what, a distance of 4 or 5 miles?
Yeah, that's about it. That's about right. I brought up the supplies, as it were, the food, the rations, the POL. And some of the members of the battery were not part of the first echelon. And we went into the battery position and deployed in the wagon lines and just went on from there as part of the battery.
Was it an anticlimax?
No, I don't think it was an anticlimax. If I hadn't ended up in the forward defense lines, it might have been an anticlimax. But the fact that I ended up there with all these large trucks full of ammunition and petrol, etc., and shouldn't have been there in the first place and drew enemy fire straight away, that was a bit scary and very stupid on my part. But, you know, it's you're pretty apprehensive when you first go into battle. You've trained in England for 4 years, you reckon your standard of training is pretty high, and then all of a sudden you're faced with live action, And it's different. You can train all you like, but there's nothing like action itself to turn you into a much better soldier. And I don't know how long it takes, but when you first go in, you're pretty leery and somewhat scared. There's no doubt about that. Until you get your feet in the ground and you realize what you're doing, and you've undergone some enemy fire and so on, and eventually it becomes, as I said, more or less routine, because the pressure is off after the Germans realized they couldn't push us back into the sea, and they were running short of ammunition and reinforcements. They couldn't keep up that pace, that pressure, continually. So eventually it slackened off, and then we got down to a more normal form of battle. You weren't fighting 24 hours a day every day.
You mentioned earlier that you were having a particularly high casualty rate amongst your forward observers.
Well, I wouldn't say particularly high, but we did have some casualties, particularly with the forward observers, as the infantry did. And although I went in as second in command of the battery, because we did have these casualties, I was told to become a forward observer and go forward and support the Regina Rifles, which I did, until such time as some reinforcement officers appeared and took over again, which was fine. It was a great experience, and there's nothing like living with the infantry and fighting with the infantry and being in their hip pocket, which is the way, what we call it. You've got to be in the infantry commander's hip pocket if you're going to provide the support that he deserves.
So you would be with them, and preparatory to an assault by them or some action, you would relay back the coordinates for the fire support.
Oh yeah.
By wireless or
Radio, yeah, or wireless, it was called in those days. That's right. Now they call it radio. Your responsibilities are many. First of all, and primarily, you're the artillery advisor to that commander, whatever level you're working at. In my case, as a captain, I was the troop commander, artillery advisor to the infantry company commander. And any time he needed advice in artillery matters, he turned to me, and it's my job to provide it. Secondly, it was my job to provide, if a target appeared suddenly, it was my job to engage it and destroy it if possible. That's the second responsibility. The third responsibility is fire planning. When the infantry is preparing to put in an attack, they need artillery support. And that support can take many forms. It could be a simple barrage, or it could be a number of individual concentrations on known enemy locations, or it could be something else. It could be a straight line of fire called, in those days, a stonk. But as the artillery advisor to the company commander, you were expected to provide all forms of artillery support, not just with your troop, because as a troop commander or a forward observer, we had call on a battery of guns, 8 guns, or we could request, and regimental headquarters would approve or disapprove, we could request the whole regiment, which was 24 guns on a particular target. Or, as it was later developed to a greater degree of efficiency, you could request the whole divisional artillery, 72 guns on a target. If the target was big enough and warranted that many guns, mm-hmm. It depends.
Did you ever have the opportunity or the necessity of calling down that amount of firepower?
Nothing larger than the regiment. I called down the whole regiment, 24 guns, yeah.
And on what, can you recall?
Yes, this is getting ahead of myself a little bit, but eventually when we got into Caen, and I was again with the Regina Rifles in Caen, and again I was doing troop commander. I can't remember why I was doing troop commander, but I was. And I went in on foot with a radio and an operator, and eventually established an OP, and I could not see a gun, but I could see a gun flash coming from behind a railway embankment. And it was obvious to me that there was one or more German guns deployed behind that railway embankment. Although I couldn't see it, I could see the gun flash. So, considering my artillery training and what we were taught on courses, I engaged this one gun with one of our own guns, and went through the proper procedures, a verified short bracket, and then into so many rounds gunfire. And my commanding officer suddenly appeared on the scene and said, "What on earth are you doing, Jake?" And I explained it to him, and he said, "My gosh, you can't even see that gun. You'll never hit it with one gun. He said, you've got to fire the whole regiment at it. Then you'll have a large area covered, and the chances are you're going to hit it with one of our guns. And that's what we did. He said, fire scale 10, which meant that every gun in the regiment would fire 10 rounds. So that was 240 rounds. We never saw another gun flash. Whether we hit the gun or he just moved out, we never knew. But that's one example I can remember.
Quite effective, yeah.
Yeah.
The opposing German artillery fire. Any comments on that?
Yes. The Germans, in my opinion, were damn good artillerymen. They knew what they were doing. And the one weapon that I think, there are two weapons they had that scared us more than anything else, and in my opinion, were more effective than any others, were first of all the Nebelwerfer, which was a multi-barrel type mortar, which you know, fire, I think 6 rounds at a time, and just scare you to death. And the other was their 88 millimeter gun, which was, I think, basically an AK-AK gun, and then converted to anti-tank, and was used in a field role, and was a very effective weapon.
Just highly accurate and
highly accurate, and yep. And the Germans knew their artillery, and their procedures were good, and we respected their artillery firing. Yeah, pretty high caliber.
Okay. The range of your guns, these 25 pounders, is
well, in yards, it was about 13,500 yards. So, 7 miles or so? Something like that. 7 or 8 miles.
And you stayed with the Winnipeg Regina Rifles right up until they took?
Well, it varied, you know. You didn't always support the same infantry battalion. It could have been the Reginas one day, and the next day the Winnipeg Rifles, or the 3rd Battalion. Can't remember which one it was. Anyway, those were the two battalions that I supported most of the time when I was doing troop forward observer. As I say, I didn't do forward observer that much because really I was a 2IC of the battery, and I was only sent up as an observer when they were short of officers.
You also mentioned earlier, Colonel, that you undertook a short reconnaissance patrol to look for some paratroopers. Maybe you could...
Yes, this was about D plus 2, I think, or D plus 3. It was early on. It was during the first week, anyway. And I remember my commanding officer called me up and said, I want to see you. And he said, I'm very concerned about my left flank. He said, there's supposed to be some British paratroopers over there. But how far away they are, I'm not sure. And whether there are Germans in between us, I'm not sure. And I'm concerned. He said, I want you to take off and go into a recce and find out what you can. Well, I did, rather nervously, I must say, because... you know, on the French roads there are stone walls on both sides in a lot of places, and if there are Germans behind those walls, all they have to do is lob a grenade over and you've like to head it. So it was a bit scary, just my driver and myself, and we went east and we drove and we were careful, and we just couldn't make contact with anybody. And I didn't go any further. I suppose I'd gone 2 or 3 miles anyway, and I couldn't go any further. So I went back and reported this to the commanding officer and said, do you want me to go back and go further? And he said, God, no, you've gone far enough. And what had happened was there was a bit of a pocket in there. The Germans were in that pocket, of course, but...
This was where?
Well, let me see now. It was between our position here west of Caen and between the Orne River here. The British paratroopers were in here, and the 3rd Canadian Division were here. But in between there, and there were Allied troops along here, but there was a pocket roughly in there which had Germans in it, and that's what I was trying to find. And whether the Germans saw me or not, I don't know, but I didn't see them, and I went back and reported it.
Any contact with tanks, German tanks?
Yes, lots of contact with German tanks. Especially when I first went forward with the Regina Rifles, and we're up in this little village here, which is west of Caen. And every night, well, I was only up there 48 hours, and I was brought back and replaced. But this little village called Nory-en-Bassin, that I remember it well. The two nights I was up there with the Reginas, the Germans attacked every night with tanks, trying to drive us back. And we held. they didn't make it, the Germans. But it was, every night was a night of great excitement.
Would you attribute that more to the tenacity of the Canadian troops?
Yes, absolutely.
They were good with.
Absolutely great, yeah. Well trained, held their ground, no panicking. You know, you couldn't see, but you could hear these rumbling tanks coming in towards you. And we'd put up flares, and you'd see the outline of the tank, and then they'd take on the tanks with their anti-tank guns. And they were stopped, but it was a great way to get your indoctrination quickly. It was exciting, very exciting. So that was my first encounter with enemy tanks.
Good. Okay, we'll take a pause.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, we're back with Colonel Beer here at his home, 3481 Cardiff Place. Day today, 28 November 1979. This is David Ganser, G-A-N-T-Z-E-R. Colonel Beer, you were about to tell us about the Carpentier Airport.
Yeah, there's not much I can tell you there, except that it was a long and drawn-out battle. The Germans fought tenaciously to hold that airfield. And they managed to hold us off for some considerable time. I honestly can't remember how long it was. I was not doing forward observer when they went in there, but just after they got in there, I was sent up to relieve a forward observer. So I do know what happened there after the Canadians took the airfield. And the enemy artillery fire on the airfield and around it after we got in there was hot and heavy. It was very heavy fire, and a combination of Nebelwerfers and 88mm guns, which just kept us down most of the time. And although the Germans tried to counterattack and retake it, they never managed to do that. So it was taken by us and held, and never given up. The next major battle that I can remember is going into Caen itself. Now this was a large city and would normally involve an awful lot of street fighting, house to house, slow business. So the decision was made that the city would be bombed, and bombed very heavily, before the troops went in. This in fact took place, and again I went in as a forward observer and again with the Regina Rifles. And when we started to go into this city, there was no way any vehicle could get through. There was so much rubble, the streets were blocked. You could get through on foot, of course, and that's how we managed to get in. But the bombing had been so heavy and so effective that there was very little opposition. At least the Regina Rifles found very little opposition. So going in on foot, I would have a signaler or a radio man with me with a pack radio set in his back. And just the two of us marching along the rubble streets with the company commander, providing support as required. When we reached our objective, the company commander set up a company headquarters in a building. And that afternoon, I happened to be outside the building while the rest of the officers were inside in the company headquarters. And I was standing there alone when all of a sudden an outdoor trap door into a basement opened, and a young German soldier with blonde hair, very young, a revolver around his waist, suddenly appeared with his hands up. So this was my first encounter with the enemy face to face, and I guess I was just as nervous as he was. But I managed to get my revolver out and pointed it at him and took his revolver away from him and marched the young boy into the company headquarters and handed him over to the company commander. This to me was a pretty eerie experience, something I'd never been through before. But in action you learn quickly, and fortunately nothing happened. I said that there was little opposition that we ran into in Caen. However, northeast, just northeast of Caen, in a factory area called Colombelle, the enemy did hold up there and did provide some considerable resistance for a period of time. They, of course, were eventually cleared out, but As I remember it, most of the resistance was in the Colombelle area as opposed to in the Caen area.
What was the French population? Were they giving you any sort of tacit assistance, or were they in evidence, or what?
They were not in evidence. At least I don't remember seeing them. When the battle was on, when the bombing was taking place, I presume they all took cover in their basements or wherever they could. And when we went through on foot, I do not remember seeing any civilians at all, to be quite frank about it. When we occupied this house and set it up as a company headquarters, even there I don't remember seeing any civilians at all. Now, whether they cleared out of the Caen area, I don't know. But I didn't see any. After that, once Caen was taken, then great preparations were made to pursue the enemy or fight the enemy down the Falaise Road to the southeast. And eventually the aim, of course, was to close the gap with General Patton and the American forces coming up from the south, and the Canadians, British, and Poles fighting from the north. This was slow going and hard work, and the Germans were just magnificent in their defense. They had series of defense lines. When they couldn't hold a defensive position for any longer, they would eventually vacate it and move back very cleverly to the next line of defense, which is a series of slit trenches and so on. And that way they managed to delay us time and time again. And the fighting that took place down that Falaise Road was just ferocious. You had to fight literally for every foot of ground you got. The Poles fought terribly well, and I can remember being sent over at one stage to liaise with the Poles, the Polish Army Division, which was happened to be on our left at that particular time. Liaising with them and trying to act as a go-between and providing artillery support to them in one of their attacks. I was only there a couple of days, but this was interesting to me, something different. Another thing that happened on that road was in one of the attacks that we participated in, one of the targets was a quarry in enemy lines, of course, and the Air Force, basically Canadian Air Force, had that quarry as a target, and they came over to bomb it. Well, it just so happened that my battery happened to be deployed around and in another quarry to the northwest,